content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the New Yorker Hour on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I'm Evan Mercer, and today, from the April 8th, 2019 edition of the New Yorker magazine, I'll read an article about a young scientist who makes the discovery of his life and sheds light on the dinosaur's final hours. And I'll follow this with a review of the poetry of David Baker. We'll begin today with an article from the Annals of the Former World Department, an article called "The Day the Earth Died, A Young Paleontologist Makes the Find of His Life" by Douglas Preston. If, on a certain evening about 66 million years ago, you had stood somewhere in North America and looked up at the sky, you would have soon made out what appeared to be a star. If you watched for an hour or two, the star would have seemed to grow in brightness, although it barely moved. That's because it was not a star, but an asteroid, and it was headed directly for Earth at about 45,000 miles an hour. 60 hours later, the asteroid hit. The air in front was compressed and violently heated, and it blasted a hole through the atmosphere, generating a supersonic shockwave. The asteroid struck a shallow sea where the Yucatan Peninsula is today. In that moment, the Cretaceous period ended, and the Paleogene period began. A few years ago, scientists at Los Alamos National Laboratory used what was then one of the world's most powerful computers, the so-called Q machine, to model the effects of the impact. The result was a slow-motion, second-by-second, false-color video of the event. Within 2 minutes of slamming into Earth, the asteroid, which was at least 6 miles wide, had gouged a crater about 18 miles deep and lofted 25 trillion metric tons of debris into the atmosphere. Picture the splash of a pebble falling into pond water, but on a planetary scale. When Earth's crust rebounded, a peak higher than Mount Everest briefly rose up. The energy release was more than that of a billion Hiroshima bombs, but the blast looked nothing like a nuclear explosion with its signature mushroom cloud. Instead, the initial blowout formed a rooster tail, a gigantic jet of molten material which exited the atmosphere, some of it fanning out over North America. Much of the material was several times hotter than the surface of the sun, and it set fire to everything within 1,000 miles. In addition, an inverted cone of liquefied, superheated rock rose, spread outward as countless red-hot blobs of glass called tektites, and blanketed the Western Hemisphere. Some of the ejecta escaped Earth's gravitational pull and went into irregular orbits around the sun. Over millions of years, bits of it found their way to other planets and moons in the solar system. Mars was eventually strewn with the debris, just as pieces of Mars knocked aloft by ancient asteroid impacts have been found on Earth. A 2013 study in the journal Astrobiology estimated that tens of thousands of pounds of impact rubble may have landed on Titan, a moon of Saturn, and on Europa and Callisto, which orbit Jupiter, three satellites the scientists believe may have promising habitats for life. Mathematical models indicate that at least some of this vagabond debris still harbored living microbes. The asteroid may have sown life throughout the solar system, even as it ravaged life on Earth. The asteroid was vaporized on impact. Its substance, mingling with vaporized Earth rock, formed a fiery plume which reached halfway to the moon before collapsing in a pillar of incandescent dust. Computer models suggest that the atmosphere within 1,500 miles of ground zero became red hot from the debris storm, triggering gigantic forest fires. As the Earth rotated, the airborne material converged at the opposite side of the planet, where it fell and set fire to the entire Indian subcontinent. Measurements of the layer of ash and soot that eventually coated the earth indicated that fires consumed about 70% of the world's forests. Meanwhile, giant tsunamis resulting from the impact churned across the Gulf of Mexico, tearing up coastlines, sometimes peeling up hundreds of feet of rock, pushing debris inland and then sucking it back out into deep water, leaving jumbled deposits that oilmen sometimes encounter in the course of deep sea drilling. The damage had only begun. Scientists still debate many of the details, which are derived from the computer model and from field studies of the debris layer, knowledge of extinction rates, fossils and microfossils, and many other clues. But the overall view is consistently grim. The dust and soot from the impact and the conflagrations prevented all sunlight from reaching the planet's surface for months. Photosynthesis all but stopped, killing most of the plant life, extinguishing the phytoplankton in the oceans, and causing the amount of ocean oxygen in the atmosphere to plummet. After the fires died down, Earth plunged into a period of cold, perhaps even a deep freeze. Earth's two essential food chains, in the sea and on the land, collapsed. About 75% of all species went extinct. More than 99.9999% of all living organisms on Earth died, and the carbon cycle came to a halt. The Earth itself became toxic. When the asteroid struck, it vaporized layers of limestone, releasing into the atmosphere a trillion tons of carbon dioxide, 10 billion tons of methane, and a billion tons of carbon monoxide. All three are powerful greenhouse gases. The impact also vaporized anhydrite rock, which blasted 10 trillion tons of sulfur compounds aloft. The sulfur combined with water to form sulfuric acid, which then fell as an acid rain that may have been potent enough to strip the leaves from any surviving plants and to leach the nutrients from the soil. Today, the layer of debris, ash and soot deposited by the asteroid strike is preserved in the Earth's sediment as a stripe of black about the thickness of a notebook. This is called the K-T boundary because it marks the dividing line between the Cretaceous period and the Tertiary period. The Tertiary period has been redefined as a Paleogene, but the term K-T persists. Mysteries abound above and below the KT layer. In the late Cretaceous, widespread volcanoes spewed vast quantities of gas and dust into the atmosphere, and the air contained far higher levels of carbon dioxide than the air we breathe now. The climate was tropical, and the planet was perhaps entirely free of ice. Yet scientists know very little about the animals and plants that were living at the time, and as a result, they have been searching for fossil deposits as close to the KT boundary as possible. One of the central mysteries of paleontology is the so-called 3-meter problem. In a century and a half of assiduous searching, almost no dinosaur remains have been found in the layers 3 meters, or about 9 feet, below the KT boundary, a depth representing many thousands of years. Consequently, numerous paleontologists have argued that the dinosaurs were on the way to extinction long before the asteroid struck, owing perhaps to the volcanic eruptions and climate change. Other scientists have countered that the 3-meter problem merely reflects how hard it is to find fossils. Sooner or later, they've contended, a scientist will discover dinosaurs much closer to the moment of destruction. Locked in the KT boundary are the answers to our questions about one of the most significant events in the history of life on the planet. If one looks at the Earth as a kind of living organism, as many biologists do, you could say that it was shot by a bullet and almost died. Deciphering what happened on the day of destruction is crucial not only to solving the 3-meter problem, but also to explaining our own genesis as a species. On August 5th, 2013, I received an email from a graduate student named Robert DePalma. I had never met DePalma, but we had corresponded on paleontological matters for years, ever since he had read a novel I'd written that centered on the discovery of a fossilized Tyrannosaurus rex killed by the KT impact. He wrote to me and said, "I have made an incredible and unprecedented discovery. And it is extremely confidential, and only 3 others know of it at the moment, all of them close colleagues." He went on, "It is far more unique and far rarer than any simple dinosaur discovery. I would prefer not outlining the details via email, if possible." He gave me a cell phone number and a time to call. I called, and he told me that he had discovered a site like the one I'd imagined in my novel, which contained, among other things, direct victims of the catastrophe. At first, I was skeptical. DePalma was a scientific nobody, a PhD candidate at the University of Kansas, and he said that he had found the site with no institutional backing and no collaborators. I thought he was likely exaggerating, or that he might even be crazy. You know, paleontology has more than its share of unusual people. But I was intrigued enough to get on a plane to North Dakota to see for myself. DePalma's find was in the Hell Creek Geological Formation, which outcrops in parts of North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, and contains some of the most storied dinosaur beds in the world. At the time of the impact, the Hell Creek landscape consisted of steamy, subtropical lowlands and floodplains along the shores of an inland sea. The land teemed with life, and the conditions were excellent for fossilization, with seasonal floods and meandering rivers that rapidly buried dead animals and plants. Dinosaur hunters first discovered these rich fossil beds in the late 19th century. In 1902, Barnum Brown, a flamboyant dinosaur hunter who worked at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, found the first Tyrannosaurus rex here, causing a worldwide sensation. One paleontologist estimated that in the Cretaceous period, Hell Creek was so thick with T-Rexes that they were like hyenas on the Serengeti. It was also home to Triceratops and duckbills. The Hell Creek Formation spanned the Cretaceous and the Paleogene periods, and paleontologists have known for at least half a century that an extinction had occurred then, because dinosaurs were found below, but never above, the KT layer. This was not true only in Hell Creek, but all over the world. For many years, scientists believed that the KT extinction was no great mystery. Over millions of years, volcanism, climate change, and other events gradually killed off many forms of life. But in the late 1970s, a young geologist named Walter Alvarez and his father, Luis Alvarez, a nuclear physicist, discovered that the KT layer was laced with unusually high amounts of the rare metal iridium, which, they hypothesized, was from the dusty remains of an asteroid impact. In an article in Science published in 1980, they proposed that this impact was so large that it triggered the mass extinction, and that the KT layer was the debris from the event. Most paleontologists rejected the idea that a sudden, random encounter with space junk had drastically altered the evolution of life on Earth. But as the years passed, the evidence mounted until in a 1991 paper, the smoking gun was announced, the discovery of an impact crater buried under thousands of feet of sediment in the Yucatan Peninsula of exactly the right age and of the right size and geochemistry to have caused a worldwide cataclysm. The crater and the asteroid were named Chicxulub after a small Mayan town near the epicenter. One of the authors of the 1991 paper, David Kring, was so frightened by what he learned of the impact's destructive nature that he became a leading voice in calling for a system to identify and neutralize threatening asteroids. He told me, "There's no uncertainty to this statement. The Earth will be hit by a Chicxulub-sized asteroid again unless we deflect it. Even a 300-meter rock would end world agriculture." In 2010, 41 researchers in many scientific disciplines announced in a landmark science article that the issue should be considered settled. A huge asteroid impact caused the extinction. But opposition to the idea remains passionate. The main competing hypothesis is that the colossal Deccan volcanic eruptions in what would become India spewed enough sulfur and carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to cause a climate shift. The eruptions, which began before the KT impact and continued after it, were among the biggest in Earth's history, lasting hundreds of thousands of years and burying 500,000 square miles of the Earth's surface a mile deep in lava. The 3-meter gap below the KT layer, proponents argued, was evidence that the mass extinction was well underway by the time of the asteroid strike. In 2004, De Palma, at the time a 22-year-old paleontology undergraduate, began excavating a small site in the Hell Creek Formation. The site had once been a pond, and the deposit consisted of very thin layers of sediment. Normally, one geological layer might represent thousands or millions of years, but De Palma was able to show that each layer in the deposit had been laid down in a single big rainstorm. He told me, "We could see when there were buds on the trees. We could see when the cypresses were dropping their needles in the fall. We could experience this in real time." Peering at the layers was like flipping through a paleo history book that chronicled decades of ecology in its silty pages. De Palma's advisor, the late Larry Martin, urged him to find a similar site, but one that had layers closer to the KT boundary. Today, De Palma, now 37, is still working toward his PhD. He holds the unpaid position of curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Palm Beach Museum of Natural History, a nascent and struggling museum with no exhibition space. In 2012, while looking for a new pond deposit, he heard that a private collector had stumbled upon an unusual site on a cattle ranch near Bowman, North Dakota. Much of the Hell Creek land is privately owned, and ranchers will sell digging rights to whoever will pay decent money, paleontologists and commercial fossil collectors alike. The collector felt that the site, a 3-foot-deep layer exposed at the surface, was a bust. It was packed with fish fossils, but they were so delicate that they crumbled into tiny flakes as soon as they met the air. The fish were encased in layers of damp, cracked mud and sand that had never solidified. It was so soft that it could be dug with a shovel or pulled apart by hand. In July 2012, the collector showed De Palma the site and told him that he was welcome to it. "I was immediately very disappointed," De Palma told me. He was hoping for a site like the one he'd excavated earlier, an ancient pond with fine-grained, fossil-bearing layers that spanned many seasons and years. Instead, everything had been deposited in a single flood. But as De Palma poked around, he saw potential. The flood had entombed everything immediately, so specimens were exquisitely preserved. He found many complete fish, which are rare in the Hell Creek Formation, and he figured that he could remove them intact if he worked with painstaking care. He agreed to pay the rancher a certain amount for each season that he worked there. The specifics of the arrangement, as is standard practice in paleontology, are a closely guarded secret. The site is now under exclusive long-term lease. The following July, De Palma returned to do a preliminary excavation of the site. "Almost right away, I saw it was unusual," he told me. He began shoveling off the layers of soil above where he'd found the fish. This overburden is typically material that was deposited long after the specimen lived. There's little in it to interest a paleontologist, and it is usually discarded. But as soon as De Palma started digging, he noticed grayish-white specks in the layers, which looked like grains of sand, but which, under a hand lens, proved to be tiny spheres and elongated droplets. I think, oh my gosh, these look like microtectites, De Palma recalled. Microtectites are the blobs of glass that form when molten rock is blasted into the air by an asteroid impact and falls back to Earth in a solidifying drizzle. The site appeared to contain microtectites by the million. As De Palma carefully excavated the upper layers, he began uncovering an extraordinary array of fossils, exceedingly delicate but marvelously well-preserved. There's amazing plant material in there, all interlaced and interlocked, he recalled. There are log jams of wood, fish pressed against cypress tree root bundles, tree trunks smeared with amber. Most fossils end up being squashed flat by the pressure of the overlying stone. But here, everything was three-dimensional, including the fish, having been encased in a sediment all at once, which acted as a support. You see skin, you see dorsal fins literally sticking straight up in the sediments, species new to science, he said. As he dug, the momentousness of what he had come across slowly dawned upon him. If the site was what he hoped, he had made the most important paleontological discovery of the new century. After receiving De Palma's email, I made arrangements to visit the Hell Creek site. 3 weeks later, I was in Bowman. De Palma pulled up to my hotel in a Toyota 4Runner, its stereo blasting the theme to Raiders of the Lost Ark. He wore a coarse cotton work shirt, cargo pants with canvas suspenders, and a suede cowboy hat with the left brim snapped up. His face was tanned from long days in the sun, and he had a 5-day-old beard. I got in, and we drove for an hour or so, turning through a ranch gate and following a maze of bone-rattling roads that eventually petered out in a grassy basin. The scattered badlands of Hell Creek form an otherworldly landscape. This is far-flung ranching and farming country. Prairies and sunflower fields stretch to the horizon, domed by the great blue skies of the American West. Roads connect small towns, truck stop, church, motel, houses, and trailers, and lonely expanses roll by in between. Here and there, in the countryside, abandoned farmhouses lean into the ground. Over millions of years, the Hell Creek layer has been heavily eroded, leaving only remnants, which jut from the prairie like so many rotten teeth. These lifeless buttes and pinnacles are striped in beige, chocolate, yellow, maroon, russet, gray, and white. Fossils, worked loose by wind and rain, spill down the sides. When we arrived, De Palma's site lay open in front of us, a desolate hump of gray, cracked earth about the size of two soccer fields. It looked as if a piece of the moon had dropped there. One side of the deposit was cut through by a sandy wash or dry stream bed. The other ended in a low escarpment. The dig was a 3-foot-deep rectangular hole, 60 feet long by 40 feet wide. A couple of 2x4s, along with various digging tools and some metal pipe for taking core samples, leaned against the far side of the hole. As we strolled around the site, I noticed under Palma's belt a long fixed-blade knife and a sheathed bayonet, a Second World War relic that his uncle gave him when he was 12, he said. He recalled the moment of discovery. The first fossil he removed earlier that summer was a 5-foot-long freshwater paddlefish. Paddlefish still live today. They have a long, bony snout with which they probe murky water in search of food. When De Palma took out the fossil, he found underneath it a tooth from a mosasaur, a giant carnivorous marine reptile. He wondered how a freshwater fish and a marine reptile could have ended up in the same place, on a riverbank at least several miles inland from the nearest sea. At the time, a shallow body of water called the Western Interior Seaway ran from the proto-Gulf of Mexico up through part of North America. The next day, he found a 2-foot-wide tail from another marine fish. It looked as if it had been violently ripped from the fish's body. De Palma said, "If the fish is dead for any length of time, those tails decay and fall apart. But this one was perfectly intact, so I knew that it was transported at the time of death or around then. Like the mosasaur tooth, it had somehow ended up miles inland from the sea of its origin." De Palma said, "When I found that, I thought, there's no way this can't be right." The discoveries hinted at an extraordinary conclusion that he wasn't quite ready to accept. "I was 98% convinced at that point," he said. The following day, De Palma noticed a small disturbance preserved in the sediment. About 3 inches in diameter, it appeared to be a crater formed by an object that had fallen from the sky and plunked down in mud. Similar formations, caused by hailstones hitting a muddy surface, had been found before in the fossil record. As De Palma shaved back the layers to make a cross-section of the crater, he found the thing itself, not a hailstone, but a small white sphere at the bottom of the crater. It was a tektite, about 3 millimeters in diameter, the fallout from an ancient asteroid impact. As he continued excavating, he found another crater with a tektite at the bottom, and another. Glass turns to clay over millions of years, and these tektites were now clay, but some still had glassy cores. The microtektites he had found earlier might have been carried there by water, but these had been trapped where they fell, on what, De Palma believed, must have been the very day of the disaster. "When I saw that, I knew this wasn't just any flood deposit," De Palma said. "We weren't just near the KT boundary. This whole site is the KT boundary." From surveying and mapping the layers, De Palma hypothesized that a massive inland surge of water flooded a river valley and filled the low-lying area where we now stood, perhaps as a result of the KT impact tsunami, which had roared across the proto-Gulf and up the Western Interior Seaway. As the water slowed and became slack, it deposited everything that had been caught up in its travels, the heaviest material first, up to whatever was floating on the surface. All of it was quickly entombed and preserved in the muck. Dying and dead creatures, both marine and freshwater, plants, seeds, tree trunks, roots, cones, pine needles, flowers and pollen, shells, bone, teeth and eggs, tektites, shocked minerals, tiny diamonds, iridium-laden dust, ash, charcoal, and amber-smeared wood. As the sediment settled, blobs of glass rained into the mud, the largest first, and then finer and finer bits until grains sifted down like snow. "We have the whole KT event preserved in these sediments," De Palma said. "With this deposit, we can chart what happened the day the Cretaceous died." No paleontological site remotely like it had ever been found. And if De Palma's hypothesis proves correct, the scientific value of the site will be immense. When Walter Alvarez visited the dig last summer, he was astounded. "It is a truly magnificent site," he wrote to me, adding that it's surely one of the best sites ever found for telling just what happened on the day of impact. When De Palma finished showing me the dig, he introduced me to a field assistant, Rudy Pascucci, the director of the Palm Beach Museum. Pascucci, a muscular man in his 50s, was sunburned and unshaven and wore a sleeveless T-shirt, snake-proof camouflage boots, and a dusty Tilly hat. The two men gathered tools, got down on the floor of the hole, and began probing the 3-foot-high walls of the deposit. Gusts of wind stirred up clouds of dust, and rain fell. When the weather cleared, the late afternoon sun spilled across the prairie. The Palma was lost in another day in another time. "Here's a piece of wood with bark beetle traces," he said. "Plant fossils from the first several million years after the impact show almost no signs of such damage. The insects were mostly gone. The asteroid had likely struck in the fall," the Palma speculated. He had reached this conclusion by comparing the juvenile paddlefish and sturgeon he'd found with the species' known growth rates and hatching seasons. He'd also found the seeds of conifers, figs, and certain flowers. "When we analyze the pollen and diatomaceous particles, that will narrow it down," he said. In the week that followed, fresh riches emerged. More feathers, leaves, seeds, and amber, along with several other fish 3 to 5 feet long and a dozen more craters with tektites. "I have visited many paleontological sites, but I have never seen so many specimens found so quickly. Most digs are boring. Days or weeks may pass with little found. De Palma seemed to make a noteworthy discovery about every half hour." When De Palma first visited the site, he noted, partially embedded on the surface, the hip bone of a dinosaur in the Ceratopsian family, of which Triceratops is the best-known member. A commercial collector had tried to remove it years earlier. It had been abandoned in place and was crumbling from years of exposure. De Palma initially dismissed it as trash and decried the irresponsibility of the collector. Later, though, he wondered how the bone, which was heavy, had arrived there, very close to the high water mark of the flood. "It must have floated," he said, "and to have done so, it must have been encased in desiccated tissue," suggesting that at least one dinosaur species was alive at the time of the impact. He later found a suitcase-sized piece of fossilized skin from a ceratopsian attached to the hip bone. At one point, De Palma set off to photograph the layers of the deposit, which had been cut through and exposed by the sandy wash. He scraped smooth a vertical section and misted it with water from a spray bottle to bring out the color. The bottom layer was jumbled. The first rush of water had ripped up layers of mud, gravel, and rocks and tumbled them about with pieces of burned and burning wood. Then De Palma came to a faint, jug-shaped outline in the wall of the wash. He examined it closely. It started as a tunnel at the top of the KT layer, went down, and then widened into a round cavity filled with soil of a different color, which stopped at the hard sandstone of the undisturbed bedrock layer below. It looked as though a small animal had dug through the mud to create a hideout. "Is that a burrow?" I asked. De Palma scraped the area smooth with his bayonet and then sprayed it. "You're darn right it is," he said, "and this isn't the burrow of a small dinosaur. It's a mammal burrow." Burrows have characteristic shapes depending on the species that inhabit them. He peered at it, his eyes inches from the rock, probing it with the tip of the bayonet. "Gosh, I think it's still in there." He planned to remove the entire burrow intact, in a block, and run it through a CT scanner back home to see what it contained. "Any Cretaceous mammal burrow is incredibly rare," he said. "But this one is impossible. It's dug right through the KT boundary." Perhaps, he said, the mammal survived the impact and the flood, burrowed into the mud to escape the freezing darkness, and then died. "It may have been born in the Cretaceous and died in the Paleocene," he said. "And to think, 66 million years later, a stinky monkey is digging it up, trying to figure out what happened." He added, "If it's a new species, I'll name it after you." When I left Hell Creek, De Palma pressed me on the need for secrecy. I was to tell no one, not even close friends, about what he'd found. The history of paleontology is full of tales of bribery, backstabbing, and double-dealing. In the 19th century, Othniel C. Marsh and Edward Drinker Cope, the nation's two leading paleontologists, engaged in a bitter competition to collect dinosaur fossils in the American West. They raided each other's quarries, bribed each other's crews, and vilified each other in print and at scientific meetings. In 1890, the New York Herald began a series of sensational articles about the controversy with the headline, "Scientists Wage Bitter Warfare." The rivalry has since become known as the Bone Wars. The days of skullduggery and paleontology have not passed. De Palma was deeply concerned that the site would be expropriated by a major museum. De Palma knew that a screw-up with this site would probably end his career, and that his status in the field was so uncertain that he needed to fortify the find against potential criticism. He had already experienced harsh judgment when in 2015 he published a paper on a new species of dinosaur called a Dakota raptor and mistakenly inserted a fossil turtle bone in the reconstruction. Although rebuilding a skeleton from thousands of bone fragments that have commingled with those of other species is not easy, De Palma was mortified by the attacks. "I never want to go through that again," he told me. For 5 years, De Palma continued excavations at the site. He quietly shared his findings with a half dozen luminaries in the field of KT studies, including Walter Alvarez, and enlisted their help. During the winter months, when not in the field, De Palma prepared and analyzed his specimens, a few at a time, in a colleague's lab at Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. The lab was a windowless, wedge-like room in the geology building, lined with bubbling aquarium tanks and shelves, heaped with books, scientific journals, pieces of coral, mastodon teeth, seashells, and a stack of 50-caliber machine gun rounds dating from the Second World War that the lab's owner had recovered from the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. De Palma had carved out a space for himself in a corner, just large enough for him to work on one or two jacketed fossils at a time. When I first visited the lab in April 2014, a block of stone 3 feet long by 18 inches wide lay on a table under bright lights and a large magnifying lens. The block, De Palma said, contained a sturgeon and a paddlefish, along with dozens of smaller fossils and a single small perfect crater with a tektite in it. The lower parts of the block consisted of debris, fragments of bone, and loose tektites that had been dislodged and caught up in the turbulence. The block told the story of the impact in microcosm. "It was a very bad day," De Palma said. "Look at these two fish." And he showed me where the sturgeon's scutes, the sharp bony plates on its back, had been forced into the body of the paddlefish. One fish was impaled on the other. The mouth of the paddlefish was agape, and jammed into its gill rakers were microtektites, sucked in by the fish as it tried to breathe. De Palma said, "This fish was likely alive for some time after being caught in the wave, long enough to gasp frenzied mouthfuls of water in a vain attempt to survive." Gradually, De Palma was piecing together a potential picture of the disaster. By the time the site flooded, the surrounding forest was already on fire, given the abundance of charcoal, charred wood, and amber he'd found at the site. The water arrived not as a curling wave, but as a powerful, rolling rise, packed with disoriented fish and plant and animal debris, which De Palma hypothesized were laid down as the water slowed and receded. At the bottom of the deposit, in a mixture of heavy gravel and tektites, De Palma identified the broken teeth and bones, including hatchling remains, of almost every dinosaur group known from Hell Creek, as well as pterosaur remains, which had been previously found only in layers far below the KT boundary. He found, intact, an unhatched egg containing an embryo, a fossil of immense research value. The egg and the other remains suggested that dinosaurs and major reptiles were probably not staggering into extinction on that fateful day. In one fell swoop, De Palma may have solved the 3-meter problem and filled in the gap in the fossil record. By the end of the 2013 field season, De Palma was convinced that the site had been created by an impact flood, but he lacked conclusive evidence that it was the KT impact. It was possible that it resulted from another giant asteroid strike that occurred at around the same time. Extraordinary discoveries require extraordinary evidence, he said. If his tektites shared the same geochemistry as tektites from the Chicxulub asteroid, he'd have a strong case. Deposits of the Chicxulub tektites are rare. The best source discovered in 1990 is a small outcrop in Haiti on a cliff above a road cut. In late January 2014, De Palma went there to gather tektites and sent them to an independent lab in Canada, along with tektites from his own site. The samples were analyzed at the same time with the same equipment. The results indicated a near-perfect geochemical match. In the first few years after De Palma's discoveries, only a handful of scientists knew about them. One was David Burnham, De Palma's thesis advisor at Kansas, who estimates that De Palma's site will keep specialists busy for at least half a century. "Robert's got so much stuff that's unheard of," Burnham told me. "Amber with tektites embedded in it? Holy cow! The dinosaur feathers are crazy good, but the burrow makes your head reel." In paleontology, the term Lagerstätte refers to a rare type of fossil site with a large variety of specimens that are nearly perfectly preserved, a sort of fossilized ecosystem. "It's going to be a famous site," Burnham said. "It will be in the textbooks. It is the Lagerstätte of the KT extinction." Jan Smit, a paleontologist at Brugge University in Amsterdam and a world authority on the KT impact, has been helping De Palma analyze his results. And, like Burnham and Walter Alvarez, he is a co-author of a scientific paper that De Palma is publishing about the site. There are eight other co-authors. "This is really a major discovery," Smith said. "It solves the question of whether dinosaurs went extinct at exactly that level or whether they declined before. And this is the first time we see direct victims." I asked if the results would be controversial. "When I saw his data with paddlefish, sturgeon, and the ammonite, I think he's right on the spot," Smith said. "I am very sure he has a pot of gold." In September of 2016, De Palma gave a brief talk about the discovery at the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America in Colorado. He mentioned only that he had found a deposit from a KT flood that had yielded glass droplets, shocked minerals, and fossils. He had christened the site Tanis after the ancient city in Egypt, which was featured in the 1981 film Raiders of the Lost Ark, as the resting place of the Ark of the Covenant. In the real Tanis, archaeologists found an inscription in three writing systems, which, like the Rosetta Stone, was crucial in translating ancient Egyptian. De Palma hopes that his Tanis site will help decipher what happened on the first day after the impact. The talk, limited though it was, caused a stir. Kirk Cochran, a professor at the School of Marine and Atmospheric Science at Stony Brook University in New York, recalled that when De Palma presented his findings, there were gasps of amazement in the audience. Some scientists were wary. All expressed a desire to see the final paper, which will be published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, so that they could evaluate the data for themselves. After the GSA talk, De Palma realized that his theory of what had happened at Tanis had a fundamental problem. The KT tsunami, even moving at more than 100 miles an hour, would have taken many hours to travel the 2,000 miles to the site. The rainfall of glass blobs, however, would have hit the area and stopped within about an hour after the impact. And yet, the tektites fell into an inactive flood. The timing was all wrong. This was not a paleontological question. It was a problem of geophysics and sedimentology. Smith was a sedimentologist, and another researcher whom De Palma shared his data with, Mark Richards, now of the University of Washington, was a geophysicist. At dinner one evening in Nagpur, India, where they were attending a conference, Smith and Richards talked about the problem, looked up a few papers, and later jotted down some rough calculations. It was immediately apparent to them that the KT tsunami would have arrived too late to capture the falling tektites. The wave would also have been too diminished by its long journey to account for the 35-foot rise of water at Tanis. One of them proposed that the wave might have been created by a curious phenomena known as a seiche. In large earthquakes, the shaking of the ground sometimes causes water in ponds, swimming pools, and bathtubs to slosh back and forth. Richards recalled that the 2011 Japanese earthquake produced bizarre 5-foot seiche waves in an absolutely calm Norwegian fjord 30 minutes after the quake, in a place unreachable by the tsunami. Richards had previously estimated that the worldwide earthquake generated by the KT impact could have been 1,000 times stronger than the biggest earthquake ever experienced in human history. Using that gauge, he calculated that potent seismic waves would have arrived at Tanis 6 minutes, 10 minutes, and 13 minutes after the impact. Different types of seismic waves travel at different speeds. The brutal shaking would have been enough to trigger a large seiche, and the first blobs of glass would have started to rain down seconds or minutes afterward. They would have continued to fall as the seiche waves rolled in and out, depositing layer upon layer of sediment and each time sealing the tektites in place. The Tanis site, in short, did not span the first day of the impact. It probably recorded the first hour or so. This fact, if true, renders the site even more fabulous than previously thought. It is almost beyond credibility that a precise geological transcript of the most important 60 minutes of Earth's history could still exist millions of years later. A sort of high-speed, high-resolution video of the event recorded in fine layers of stone. De Palma said, "It's like finding the Holy Grail clutched in the bony fingers of Jimmy Hoffa sitting on top of the Lost Ark." If Tanis had been closer to or farther from the impact point, this beautiful coincidence of timing could not have happened. "There's nothing in the world that's ever been seen like this," Richards told me. One day, 65 million years ago, life on Earth almost came to a shattering end. The world that emerged after the impact was a much simpler place. When sunlight finally broke through the haze, it illuminated a hellish landscape. The oceans were empty. The land was covered with drifting ash. The forests were charred stumps. The cold gave way to extreme heat as a greenhouse effect kicked in. Life mostly consisted of mats of algae and growths of fungus. For years after the impact, the earth was covered with little other than ferns. Furtive, rat-like mammals lived in the gloomy understory. But eventually, life emerged and blossomed again in new forms. The KT event continues to attract the interest of scientists, in no small part because the ashen print it left on the planet is an existential reminder. "We wouldn't be here talking on the phone if that meteorite hadn't fallen," Smith told me with a laugh. De Palma agreed. For the first 100 million years of their existence, before the asteroid struck, mammals scurried about the feet of the dinosaurs, amounting to little. "But when the dinosaurs were gone, it freed them," De Palma said. "In the next epoch, mammals underwent an explosion of adapted radiation, evolving into a dazzling variety of forms, from tiny bats to gigantic titanosaurs, from horses to whales, from fearsome creodonts to large-brained primates with hands that could grasp and minds that could see through time." "We can trace our origins back to that event," De Palma said. "To actually be there at this site, to see it, to be connected to that day, is a special thing. This is the last day of the Cretaceous. When you go one layer up the very next day, that's the Paleocene. That's the age of mammals. That's our age. And now in the books section, a review entitled A Still Small Poem, David Baker Bears Witness to the Natural World by Dan Chiasson. David Baker is a poet of American antipastoral. His mind operates against the vividly rendered landscape of small town Ohio, where he has lived for more than 30 years. Baker's poems depend on long acquaintance with a small place, where year over year comparison makes even the arrival of a feeding monarch or a nagging blue jay a standout event. His work evinces the moral courage of keeping still in the landscape in our era of climate change. Poetry's mandate to measure the rhythms of the year has become a valuable form of witness. Baker's reports from the interior leave in all the encroachments that threaten it. He is heir to such writers as Henry David Thoreau, who marked the loss of Sudbury River shad after a dam was built upstream, and Robert Frost, who heard in the song of the oven bird the ominous news that the highway dust is over all. Baker is a professor of English at Denison University and the longtime poetry editor of the Kenyon Review. Swift, New and Selected Poems, published by Norton, samples 8 of his collections and adds a ravishing suite of new elegies for his parents. The volume affords a longitudinal view of a sensibility that is itself devoted to observing change over time. Baker's poems often veer toward a kind of hubris and then abruptly away. His style is full of second guesses, and as his work matures, he makes a virtue of hesitation. Swift is organized in reverse chronology, but I started at the back to watch Baker's early motifs return and change. The hedge apples appear as food for starving deer, not as fodder for symbolism. The deer themselves keep returning, grim timekeepers, seemingly hungrier and in greater numbers. In Late Pastoral from 2000, they are driven towards us by nothing to forage, by vanishing trees and raised fields, by exurbs, by white flight, and our insatiate hunger for size and space and tax advantages. In Too Many, a poem published in 2009, the deer have become, in the eyes of Baker's neighbors, a menace plague, though he sees that the real plague is human sprawl. Nearly running the creature over with his mower, Baker discovers in the tall grasses a just come to the world fawn, speckled, wet as a trout. His metaphors buckle to contain this extraordinarily delicate sight. The fawn endangered by the plow, a common pastoral motif, is also like a tan seashell and a mewing kitten. The only conclusion to be drawn is that there are so many, too many of us. And yet, the world keeps making. This makes no sense. In his later work from Midwest Ecologue, published in 2005 and forward, Baker has troubled the idea that poems might tame the world by metaphor. But he's not dismissive of the human need to try, and he has built a style out of his own and others' setbacks. In Hyper, a beautiful poem about his daughter's diagnosis of ADHD, Baker describes how seeing 4 deer in a neighbor's bean field becomes, for father and daughter alike, an absolute attention, a fixity. Both of them must decide what representing the deer requires. The girl, momentarily self-forgetful, is absorbed in her process, hunkered over her drawing pad, humming for an hour. She edits the 4 deer down to a classical 3 and draws the beans in idealized rows. Her father, the poet, keeps qualifying and refining his descriptions. Then a stillness descended the blue hills, he writes. After a beat, as though doubting the word, I say stillness. By the end of the poem, he has settled on a version of a sentence that the reader has seen him struggle to get right. We watched four deer in stillness walking there. It's in perfect iambic pentameter. In The Rumor from 2009, a poem about a big cat, probably a mountain lion, in the nearby countryside, he describes the remnants of a deer's corpse at the base of a beech tree. Consider thus the tufts and tailpiece, hooves cleft from the legs, what's left of them, where they dropped concentric beneath the beech. The abrupt line breaks suggest a formal face-off between composure and violence that in some ways mimics the animal's struggle. To read Baker's poems collected in this way is to appreciate the full range of their formal resources, their attunement to cycles and processes rather than to mere outcomes and effects, their patience over the long haul. He sees little economies everywhere he looks. In The Spring Ephemerals, a trillium belongs to a complex ecosystem of rue anemone masses, of coltsfoot, wild ginger, bloodroot, and May apples, bracken, and fiddlehead fern. The entire catalog, which sounds like something from Milton's Lycidas, is in fact a list of fragile plants imperiled by road graders, their tenuous network disrupted. Baker is a poet of systems and of the interrelatedness of apparently discrete phenomena. A poem about an empty field is also of necessity a poem about developers, zoning boards, and town meetings. The poems are often themselves complex systems, their vocabularies interlocking like machine parts. Now, assembled as a whole, the machines can be perceived as an even larger operation, a mind susceptible to change, alert to the conditions that affect it. A long, astonishing sequence in Scavenger Loop from 2015 begins with a trash picker and passes through Facebook shares and likes, cell mutation, GMOs, and compost. Each of these threads tracks with intelligence that feels both adversarial to lyric poetry and vital to it, the metastatic path of matter. The poem is an elegy for Baker's mother, but there's something in it for everyone to grieve. Well, we've run out of time for today's broadcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed reading it. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Today's broadcast, as well as all previous New Yorker readings, are available as podcasts at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Well, that's it for today. Until next time, this is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.